Well, good evening, everybody. It's very nice to have Adair here again. He needs no introduction here or anywhere else, but I'll give him one. As you know, he was the former Director General of the CBI. Then he wrote an excellent book called Just Capital, a memorable title. Now he's Vice Chairman of Merrill Lynch Europe, but he's also active in the public arena. He's Chair of the Low Pay Commission, and he's recently become chair of the Pension Commission, which the government has set up, which is a slight element of background to this talk, makes it especially interesting. Even more important, he's a visiting professor at the LSE and chair of the Policy Committee of the Centre for Economic Performance. Now, there was once a foreign conductor of a British orchestra who was having some trouble with the orchestra. And this provoked him to say to them, you may think I know fucking nothing about British orchestras, but I can tell you I know fuck all. Well, Adair is somebody who knows all about everything. Today he's going to talk to us about demographics, economics and social choice. He asked me to mention that he gave a lecture on some of the detailed economics of pensions at the Institute of Actuaries, which he's not going to repeat, but it's on the CEP website. I happened to hear it, and I can tell you it's an excellent lecture, which I strongly recommend. But tonight he's going to address wider issues to do with the demographic choices that we face. Adair.
Well, thank you, Richard. Demographic trends were not, till recently, a major subject of public debate. Actuaries and demographers have been aware for years that something really rather big is happening, but demographics has rarely made headlines. But that really has changed quite rapidly over the last few years. As Richard has said, I chair the UK's Commission on Pension Policy, and each week I get the latest press clippings, which are an endless series of headlines talking of pension crisis, pension black hole, and work till you drop. And throughout Europe, pension reform and opposition to pension reform has shot to the top of the political agenda. And increasingly, commentators are stressing, I think correctly, that pension system problems are not some sort of technical issues requiring just technical solutions, but raise far wider questions. Many press commentators now refer to UN or OECD estimates that Europe needs tens of millions or hundreds of millions of immigrants if it is to support its old people. David Willetts, Britain's chief opposition spokesman on pensions and employment affairs, recently issued a pamphlet arguing that Britain should at least consider what policies would increase birth rates. And The Economist recently summed it up a few weeks ago with this front page: work longer, have more babies, how to solve Europe's pension crisis. So my purpose this evening is not to explore the details of pension system design, but to consider some wider social and economic issues. And to have time to cover those wider issues, I'm going to skip over some details of pension system economics, and I'm going to assert some arguments rather than prove them. But as Richard said, I address the details of pension system economics in a recent lecture to the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries, a copy of which will be put on the website as it were, a companion lecture to this one. Now, future demographic trends are uncertain. We know what has happened in the past to longevity and fertility, but any future projections are just projections. And with United Nations estimates of global population in 2050 ranging from 7.4 billion to 10.6 billion, projections come with some big caveats. But despite those caveats, I think that the direction of the key trends, if not their precise pace, is fairly clear. And I'm therefore going to focus on the impact of the trends, and I'm going to use the UN's, the United Nations, medium variant projection to illustrate my points. Now, European demographics are changing as a result of three factors. One is increasing longevity. The second is declining fertility, declining birth rates. And the third is the existence of a baby boom cohort, a generation born between about 1950 and 1970, which is both larger than the one before and larger than the one afterwards. But I'm going to focus almost entirely on the first two factors and not on the baby boom, because it is the first two which define the long-term challenge facing the whole world. For specific national pension systems over the next 20 or 30 years, the baby boom effect can be very important. It makes changes in dependency ratio more rapid, though in the same direction, as those which would be produced by gradual and one-directional shifts in longevity and fertility. But my aim this evening is not to look at the next 20 or 30 years in specific pension systems, but at the overall implications and trends over, say, a 50-year period and at a global level. So what is happening to longevity and fertility? Well, longevity, life expectancy, is going up almost everywhere. It has gone up in the UK throughout the 20th century, rapidly in the first half, a slight deceleration in the 50s and 60s, acceleration since then. And it has gone up across the world, though with a deceleration recently, which is largely AIDS-related. And it has risen to around UK levels or above in all successful rich economies in Western Europe, in the US, in Japan, and it's already getting close to those levels in emerging countries like South Korea and Thailand. And in all of those countries, it's still going up. But for pension systems, what matters is not so much life expectancy at birth, which can increase due to lower infant mortality, but without the lifespan of the normal healthy person actually increasing much, but rather life expectancy at 60 or 65, how long people live from the ages at which they typically think about retiring. But that also has gone up rapidly. And again, we have the same pattern that the pace of increase slowed a bit in the 60s and in this case 70s, but accelerated quite significantly in the 1980s and 90s, and is now going up rapidly in all rich countries. Now, the key question, of course, is how far and how fast will these trends continue in future? Current official projections, for instance, in the UK from government actuaries' departments, but other country estimates tend to be similar, typically show 30 years or so of continued rapid increase, but then a tailing off thereafter. Male life expectancy up by maybe 3 or 4 years by 2030, but then increasing at a decreasing rate thereafter. But the key thing to realize is that this tailing off, which you will see in most published forecasts, reflects a highly contested assumption, the limit to life assumption, which assumes that we can get more and more people to live to, as it were, full old age, say 90 or so, but that we hit absolute biological limits much beyond that. That was an assumption for which the deceleration of the 1960s and 70s appeared to provide support, but which is challenged by the acceleration of the last 20 years, during which official projections have consistently underestimated actual improvements, and in which the forecast date at which the slowdown occurs is continually pushed out into the future. Indeed, if you look at official forecasts for the last 20 years, they always show 25 years of rapid increase and then a tailing off. It's just that the 25 years is always 25 years in front of wherever we've got to. And there is an alternative school of thought of both demographers and medics and biologists, which questions whether we have any sound basis for asserting a limit to life, and which predicts further straight-line improvements which would increase life expectancy at 65 over the next 50 years by something more like 8 years than 4 years. So it's a lively debate to which I can only refer this evening, but from which, for the purposes of the lecture, I'm going to take the following assumptions. First, that for the next 50 years, we will definitely see continued major improvements in life expectancy, both at birth and at retirement ages. Second, that those life expectancy increases may well be significantly higher than current official projections. Third, that it is possible that for the next 50 years at least, and perhaps for the next century, we may see no slowdown at all in the pace of increasing life expectancy. Let's turn to fertility. The pattern here is that birth rates are falling to or below replacement levels wherever economic prosperity is achieved. In Europe, as measured by the total fertility rate, and I'll come back in a minute to some of the caveats required when using TFRs, it fell below replacement of, let's say, 2.05 children per woman in the mid-1970s, and it is now well below replacement rates and is still falling. And it is below two in every single European country, east and west, apart from Albania, and it's even falling in Albania. In North America, and on this UN definition of North America here is US and Canada, but not Mexico, it fell below replacement slightly earlier, in fact, in the early 70s, but then it's ticked up a bit and is now at about the two replacement level. But you should be very careful of how you interpret that increase. If you split the US figures into ethnic groups, white, black, Asia-Pacific immigrants, Native American, Hispanic, you will find that the birth rates for each individual groups are all at record lows. And you will find that the most prosperous groups, white and Asian Pacific immigrants, have rates significantly below replacement levels, and that these rates have not ticked up. The increase in the aggregate is solely the result of an increasing Hispanic proportion of the population due to immigration, which therefore produces one of those weighted average effects where every single element is going down, but the weighted average is for a period of time going up. But once Hispanic fertility rates fall towards replacement, and they are clearly on that course, the average for the US will also come down significantly below two. But this is not just a European and American phenomenon. In East Asia, the decline is even more dramatic than in Europe. Japan has been at or below replacement rates since the 1960s and is now at 1.2 women per children per woman. Korea, Hong Kong, and Singapore are now at levels as low as the lowest European countries. For instance, both Hong Kong and Singapore are below Italian levels of fertility, and Italy is the lowest in Europe. China has declined to 1.8, and while that decline is partly attributable to the official one-child policy, what these other country lines tell us is that what the Chinese have done is simply bring forward into the demography of a low to middle income country a trend which would otherwise have occurred a few decades later with rising prosperity. Finally, fertility rates are falling towards replacement levels and forecast to go below it there, that level within the next 15 years in some rather surprising countries, in Brazil, in Turkey, and in perhaps the most surprising to me, in Iran, where there has been a dramatic fall in fertility rates from 7 in the early 1980s to only about 2.3 today. And all of that together suggests a striking message: the universality and almost, it seems, the economic determinism of what is going on. We sometimes talk of deep-seated cultural differences, but it seems that whenever we get three conditions, reasonable prosperity, a high level of female literacy, and a supply of contraceptives which are legal, safe, and reasonably cheap, we get, with those three conditions, fertility rates coming down towards and below replacement levels. And we get that in Catholic Italy and Brazil as much as in Lutheran Sweden and Minnesota, in Confucian China and Buddhist Thailand, in Sunni Muslim Turkey and Shiite Iran. We should always be very cautious of declaring universal sociological truths, but this actually does seem to be one. And it seems to be one even when you consider the pitfalls of fertility rate figures, because as many of you will know, TFR figures, while having the merits of being available rapidly and across the world, suffer from a key interpretation difficulty, which is that if the average age of childbirth is changing, TFR movements exaggerate changes in eventual completed family size. If, for instance, the average age of childbirth rises, which is happening throughout the world, TFRs will, for a period of time, fall more rapidly than long-term completed family size. So some of these TFR trends may slightly, but only slightly, overstate the underlying change. But the direction is clear. An analysis of the better but more difficult measure, which is completed family size, still suggests that the trend, wherever we have economic prosperity, is towards fertility rates below replacement levels. Now, in the interest of time, however, I'm going to skip over the details of that argument, which, however, will be in the written copy and on the website. So the future is longevity rising, possibly without limit, and fertility in all successful economies falling to or below replacement level. If that is the future, what happens to pension systems and what social choices do we then face? Well, the key thing that changes, of course, is the ratio of workers to retirees. Population structures can, as I'm sure you know, but just in case some of you are who are not familiar with pyramids and columns, population structures can be set out graphically by arranging the number of people in each age band in layers, and in the growing populations of the last two centuries, population structures in almost all countries have been triangles or pyramids. And the ratio of workers to retirees for any given retirement age can be clearly worked out by area A on this chart over area B, from which it is clear that if people live longer beyond retirement age, B will increase and the ratio will fall. And also that if fertility rates fall to replacement, the shape will change over time from a triangle or pyramid to a column with a small triangle on top, each generation the same size as before, almost all people surviving to, say, age 60 or 70, and then dying off over the next 20, 30 years thereafter. So dependency ratios change, and with them the economics of pension systems. And not just pay-as-you-go pension systems, but funded systems as well. Because it turns out that the difference between the economics of funded and unfunded pension systems is far less fundamental than you might think. But the easy way to understand what is going on is first to consider the classic state-run pay-as-you-go system, and then subsequently ask, how does this differ if pensions are funded? And the best place to start with the economics of PAYG systems is a classic article, one of the classics of the literature, written by Paul Samuelson in 1958, in which he set out, though it was not actually the primary purpose of the article, which was to consider the determinations of the rate of interest, he set out the crucial influence of demographics on pensions. Think first of all about a pay-as-you-go pension system in a world of no population growth and no productivity growth. Each working generation, which is of equal size, pays a percentage contribution of wages to support retirement pensions. In that world, you can easily show, the ratio of average retirement income over average worker contribution will be equal to the ratio of years spent working to the years spent in retirement. If on average you work 45 years and retire for 15, then a stable, soundly financed pension system could have pensions of 60% of average earnings and worker contributions of 20% of average earnings, a 3-to-1 ratio. Or it could have 30% pensions and 10% contributions, or 90 and 30, or any other 3-to-1 relationship you want. And the implicit rate of return on contributions made into a pay-as-you-go or social security system would in this case be nil. For every £1 of income sacrificed as a worker contribution, you would get back in retirement £1 of income, but with, as it were, no positive return on your investment. But now add population growth, but not yet productivity growth, and something rather useful happens, which is that the ratio of average retirement income to worker contributions is now working years over retirement years multiplied by the population growth which has occurred between one generation and the next. Now if you have 45 years work and 15 years retirement, but also 1% per annum population growth, you can have a stable pay-as-you-go system into which workers pay 20% of income, but with the pensioners now getting not 60%, but over 80% of average income as pensions. And that's simply because there are now more workers per pensioner. And it turns out that in this case, the implicit rate of return you get on your investment in the Social Security Fund is the rate of population growth, a rate which Samuelson labelled the biological rate of return. Finally, if we add productivity growth, we simply add another term of the equation, so that the implicit rate of return on your investment in a social security system is now population growth plus productivity growth, which is the rate of growth of the economy. But it's on the population term in both case 2 and case three that I'd like to focus, because it is that term which creates the key feature of pay-as-you-go pension schemes in rising populations, which is that pay-as-you-go pension schemes in rising populations are, to a degree, pyramid schemes, chain letters, Ponzi schemes, in that the benefits they promise in relation to what you put in crucially depends on there being more people in the next generation, in the next layer, as it were, of the pyramid scheme or the chain letter. Pension schemes didn't exist before the 20th century. People didn't live that long. They were created in the 20th century, and they were created in countries which had positive population growth. And all their mathematics, all the ratios between what you put in and what you get out, are predicated on the pyramid scheme characteristic that the next generation is larger than the generation which at any one time is putting in. And the essence of what is happening to pension systems in the face of falling fertility is that the pyramid scheme is coming to an end. But not just that, of course, but also the impact of rising longevity. Because rising longevity also affects these ratios, as is clear if we now look at the determinants of the support ratio, the number of workers over the number of retirees. The support ratio is equal, in a simple steady state model, to working years over retirement years multiplied by population growth between the generations. And it therefore clearly falls if one of two things happen. Either if longevity increases but not the age of retirement, so that years in retirement increase, the denominator there, or fertility falls and thus population growth falls. And the striking thing about these ratios is how dramatic these ratios change given quite possible changes in longevity and fertility rate. This slide, just to give you an order of magnitude effect, presents the figures from a simple steady-state model, allowing us to look at the impact of increased longevity and falling fertility without the real-world complexity of baby boom cohort effects. We assume in this that working life starts at 20 in all cases, and in both columns, the retirement age is assumed to be 65, but with a life expectancy beyond 65 at 15 in the first column, the left-hand column, and 20 in the right-hand column. And there are then three different population growth scenarios. So if we take the top left-hand figure, if population growth is plus 0.5% and the retirement age is 65, the support ratio is 3.5. But it will fall to 2.8 if life expectancy at 65 rises from 15 to 20 years, which is exactly the sort of order of magnitude that we're going to see over the next 50 years. And it will fall even further to 1.9 if population rate growth rate falls from plus 0.5% to minus 0.5%, which again is exactly the sort of growth rate change actually occurring between the Europe of 1980 and the Europe of 2030. And that is why, if you actually then look at the UN's real world projections, you end up with very similar results. Forecast falls in support ratios from 3.7 to 2.1 for the UK, 3.4 to 1.4 in Italy, 4.8 to 2.8 for the US. But note, even more dramatic for countries like China and Korea, support ratios falling from well above Western levels to well below in just 50 years. And that shift in support ratios challenges pension systems throughout the world. It faces a society with essentially just three choices: increased average retirement ages, i.e. longer working lives, poorer pensioners relative to average earnings, or bigger worker and employer contributions as a percent of earnings. And with the size of the swings required in factors 2 and 3, really very large if you don't change factor 1, retirement age. If your support ratio falls by 43%, which is precisely the projected fall for Britain on the previous page, and if you do not increase average retirement ages, you will either have to cut pensioner income by 43%, or you will have to increase worker contributions by 76%. Which of course means that average retirement ages are going to have to rise. And a reasonable rule of thumb might be that retirement ages should rise in line with rising life expectancy, keeping the ratio of working years to retirement years constant. But it is important to realise that even that would not be sufficient to keep support ratios constant. It would be sufficient if the only thing we were facing was a rising longevity. I mean, pretty obviously, if the only thing that went up was longevity, you could offset that by simply taking up retirement ages in an exactly proportional fashion. But because we face falling fertility as well as increasing longevity, proportional rise in retirement ages isn't sufficient. This is the same slide as before, but with a new column added in which life expectancy rises to 20 years beyond 65, but the retirement age moves to 68 and three quarters, keeping the ratio of working years to retirement ages still at the 3 to 1, which it is in the left-hand column. And it shows that if your population growth rate is steady at plus 0.5%, raising the retirement age proportionately fully offsets the life expectancy effect. The ratio falls from 3.5 to 2.8, but then goes back up to 3.5 if you raise the retirement age. But if at the same time your population growth rate has fallen from plus 0.5% to minus 0.5%, raising the retirement age proportionately still only gets your support ratio back to 2.55. And indeed, you would have to take in this model the retirement age to something like 73 to keep the support ratio stable. And that is the scale of the demographic challenge which Europe and the US, but also much of Asia, is facing, and which perhaps the whole world may face. Falls in support ratios which cannot be offset even by retirement ages rising fully in line with increased longevity. Which means that workers are going to have to make bigger contributions and or pensioners are going to get poorer, even if retirement ages rise proportionately. But so far I've only been speaking about pay-as-you-go state-run schemes. Don't funded pension systems get round this demographic dilemma, since workers pile up assets rather than being dependent on future workers paying taxes? Well, the short answer to that is no. And the long answer is set out in the companion lecture to which I referred earlier. But let me set out the key points of the argument that you will find in that lecture. First, in any pension system, non-funded or funded, today's pensioners are dependent on the output produced but not consumed by the current generation of workers. And what differs between funded and non-funded systems is how the resource transfers flow and the risks associated with the pensioner's claim on future output, but not the fact that it is a claim on future workers' output. A pay-as-you-go claim is a claim on future tax resources and is subject to political risk. A funded claim involves the ownership of a capital asset which gives you a right to receive future profit and rent streams, and it is subject to various categories of economic risk. But either way, a pension claim is a claim on future output and is dependent on the future workers who produce that future output. Which means, therefore, that funded systems can only help overcome demographic challenges if they increase total national savings, total investment, and therefore total future GDP or GMP, thus increasing the future output on which future pensioners are able to draw, which is a no free lunch condition. With pay-as-you-go systems, you need higher taxes if you want to avoid poorer pensioners or rising retirement ages. With funded systems, you need higher savings. And interestingly, it turns out, you need higher savings not just in this generation, but in future generations, because the future generations have to buy off you the assets that you've accumulated. And either way, you have to cut workers' consumption to make pensioners better off. Third, that the return on additional savings, if you can achieve them, is subject to demographic risks. An increase in savings to overcome rising longevity will, everything else being equal, produce a fall in the marginal rate of return. And a falling population, which means that generation two is smaller than generation one, will tend to produce a period of falling asset prices relative to the constant population alternative, since generation two's target asset accumulation will be smaller than generation one's. Fourth, that as a result, and this is where it really does get tricky to explain briefly, so you either have to trust me or read the companion lecture, demographic changes carry very similar implications for the mathematics of funded schemes as for pay-as-you-go schemes. Thus, with a pay-as-you-go scheme, if you have a rise in longevity alone, a proportionate rise in retirement age is a sufficient policy response, removing any need for increased taxes. And thus, exactly equivalently within a funded scheme, if you have rising longevity alone, a proportionate rise in the retirement age removes any need for increased savings or any danger of declining marginal returns or depressed asset prices. But once you have a fertility decline as well, both types of system face more difficult problems which simply show up in different ways. So to return to my really brief answer, no. Funded systems do not give us an escape route from demographic challenges. And they do not do so, at least in the long term, even when we take an open economy rather than a closed economy view. Some of you probably spotted that the falling return and asset price effects, to which I referred under point three, imply a closed economy in which savings have to be matched by investment. And in an open economy, the alternative exists of investment overseas, with the benefit coming back via the overseas investment income line of GMP, not via domestic output, which still requires a higher savings rate, so there really is no free lunch, but which at least means that the higher savings will not earn a falling rate of return, and that future pensioners do not have to rely on selling accumulated assets solely to a smaller next generation of domestic workers. And all that is true. The open economy case slightly changes the argument, but only up to a point and only for a transitional period. For the problem is that the countries you would like to invest in themselves face changing demographics. China, within 50 years, will have a demographic structure almost exactly in line with Britain's. I've just done a simplified version of a demographic shape here with three bands. 0 to 15 year people, the percentage of 0 to 15 years in the population, 15 to 59, and 60 plus. And what is interesting about the figures is that in 2050, Britain and China are not only similar, but on the UN medium variant, they are absolutely exactly the same. And indeed, China's pace of change from where it is now to where it will be in 50 years is, of course, faster than ours. So China is already debating its pension time bomb. And it would like to build up claims outside China to support its future retirees, not build up liabilities to support pensioners in other countries. Any British or European strategy that assumes that our pensioners will be supported by Chinese workers via capital claims on their output cannot in aggregate work if China is pursuing precisely the same policy in reverse. Which does not deny the potential of overseas investment as a transitional phase, but it is a transitional phase with a problem suggested by this slide, which is that there is a clear, though not perfect, correlation between economic success and falling fertility. Most of the countries which the capital markets would describe as attractive investment destinations are already at or near replacement level fertility, countries like China, Korea, Thailand. While at the other end, the only countries we can be confident are going to generate a demographic pyramid into the late 21st century are countries like Bangladesh, the Congo, Iraq, and Pakistan, in which most people would be somewhat wary of investing their pension investments. Now, yes, there are today some in the intermediate category. India in particular stands out as a country of attractive investment opportunities and large and still expanding population. But the big picture, and as it were, the long-term catch-22 still remains. Wherever you get economic prosperity, you get fertility falling to and below replacement level. Therefore, the stable and successful countries in which you would like to invest will all develop column-shaped demographies. And if the whole world develops a stable population with a column-shaped demography, the world cannot solve its support ratio problem by investing in other planets. Therefore, in the long term, you have to develop pension policies in individual countries and across the world which can cope with column-shaped demographies rather than dream of escaping that challenge via overseas investment designed to marry your capital to the base of someone else's population pyramid, which creates a very big challenge for the already ageing and low fertility countries, for Europe in particular. Our support ratios are falling, our pay-as-you-go state schemes are under pressure, funded schemes are only a partial solution, not fundamentally different, and overseas investment is at best a transitional answer. What to do? Well, one possibility is to try to change our demographics via either increased fertility or increased immigration. And the immigration option is now extensively debated and to a degree, of course, is happening whether people like it or not, because immigration is to a degree unstoppable. Immigration to Britain is now running at about 170,000 per annum versus about zero in the early 1990s. And the British government has recently increased its estimate of long-term sustainable growth rate from 2.5% to 2.75%, entirely because of a higher labour force growth resulting primarily from higher estimates of future immigration. And The Economist magazine, when not arguing for more fertility, argues for more immigration. A recent lead editorial was headlined, "Net immigration into Britain is higher than it has ever been. Good." And newspaper articles now frequently refer to estimates of how many immigrants Europe needs to keep its support ratio constant. But the problem is, these numbers are huge, implying not only massive immigration, but an exploding total size of population. The UN has calculated the immigration needed to keep support ratios constant. The result would be a UK population growing from 59 to 136 million, and a European population from 372 million to 1.2 billion over 50 years, and then rising as rapidly in the next 50 years thereafter, because once you import immigrants to fix a support ratio problem, they grow old and they become pensioners, and then you need more immigrants to support them. And you only have to look at these figures to realise that this scale of immigration is undesirable, impossible, but fortunately unnecessary, because these figures assume unchanged retirement ages. And if you don't change retirement ages in the face of rising longevity, stable support ratios require not only maintained population growth, but explosive, accelerated population growth. If you go from this triangle to that triangle, and then say, I'm not going to increase the retirement age, in order to keep your ratios constant, you need not only the pace implied by the previous shape of that triangle, you need to continually splay out the base of your triangle at an ever more rapid rate. But unchanged retirement age is an absurd assumption. Retirement ages will and should rise. But we noted earlier that even a proportional rise in retirement ages is not sufficient to stabilise support ratios if fertility is falling. And that means that while these specific figures are a bit of a nonsense and really a bit of an impediment to sensible debate, there is a more realistic choice to be debated. If the European support ratio falls from 3.5 to 1.9 because of increased longevity and falling fertility, the first arrow, and if we offset some of that by a proportional increase in the retirement age, which is the second arrow, should we also plan to increase it further back to 3.5, the third arrow? That would imply population growth of the region of 0.5% per annum, say about 30% over 50 years. It would imply the UK population growing from 60 to 80 million, the European Union from 370 to 500 million, which after all would be a similar sort of population increase as is expected in the United States, and would be certainly not impossible. It wouldn't require 10 times as much immigration as we have at the moment. It would require an immigration flow to the UK of roughly twice present levels. So it is this, unlike the previous scenarios, let's say an increase of 30% to 80 million in the UK, 500 million in Europe, is within the bounds of possibility. This scenario is possible and is worth debating, and it poses a real social choice for Europe. Should we welcome mass immigration into Europe and a population increase of, say, 20 or 30% in order to keep our support ratio constant or at least falling less slowly? Well, entirely from a pension commission point of view, this would be useful. But there are far wider issues here than support ratios issues I will consider under four headings: political stroke cultural, environmental, economic, and geopolitical. The political cultural issue is whether Europe can integrate successfully, or wants to integrate, even this lower scale of immigration, the 30%, the 20 or 30% option, which is, of course, a very sensitive issue. Throughout Europe, there is considerable opposition, even to the level of immigration that there is at the moment. But there are also many people who argue if America can integrate a 30% increase in 50 years, why can't Europe? Isn't the only problem the conservatism and racism of this old continent? And even among the pro-immigration lobby, of course, there are divisions between what one might call integrationists and multiculturalists. Should immigrants to Britain be required to learn English, both to help themselves and to aid integration, or is that a form of cultural imperialism? It's a complex debate which I cannot deal with in detail, but to which I would like to make just one contribution, which is to suggest that the comparison with the US is facile, since it fails to recognise the far more difficult integration challenge which Europe would face if it went down its 30% option. We often talk of an American melting pot as if it is a successful mixing of quite different cultures. But on the whole, actually, it is not. The majority of the melting pot in America is a mixture of different variants of European culture: Italian, German, Irish, Jewish. There is also a fairly small, moderate level of Asia-Pacific immigration, often of highly skilled people, but actually Britain is fairly good at integrating those categories of people as well. And the vast majority of current immigration into America is Hispanic, involving people who speak a European language, whose Catholic religion has been for centuries a major American religion, and who come from countries such as Mexico, which, while poorer than the US, are functioning middle-income market economies already extensively influenced by American culture and attitudes. And the only American experience of mass immigration from a completely different country, which was the very specific case of involuntary black immigration via slavery, has left a legacy even 140 years after the abolition of slavery of very incomplete integration, with, for instance, measures of black-white interracial marriage or mixing of housing districts, which are much lower in the US than they are in the UK. So I do not think that America does provide us with a proven success story of the rapid integration of very large numbers of immigrants coming from a totally different cultural and economic starting point. But that is what Europe would have to achieve in order to fix the pension challenge via immigration, because the immigrants would not come from, as it were, the nearest European cultural and economic analogue of Mexico, which is Eastern Europe. They will not come in from Eastern Europe in any significant numbers, or even from Russia or the Ukraine, because the populations of those regions are small and are falling very rapidly. Eastern Europe's population is projected to fall from 126 million today to 104 million in 2050. As a result, even immigration of 10 million people from Eastern Europe would be, for Eastern European countries, a vast demographic shift, and indeed would leave, back in Eastern Europe, a potential social catastrophe of unsupported pensioners, but would be so small as to make almost no difference to Western European support ratios. So immigration from Eastern Europe is not, just in scale terms, really fundamentally relevant to the support ratio debate. Instead, to make a difference to support ratios, Europe needs mass immigration from Africa and Western Asia, here defined as Pakistan, through the Middle East to Turkey, a region which, with the notable exception of Turkey, sadly includes the world's greatest concentrations of very poor people, of failed states, and of fundamentalist regimes and cultures. The starting point economic and cultural difference between Europe and its major potential source of immigrants is far, far greater than between the US and Mexico or the rest of Latin America. Now, that does not answer the question what level of immigration would be optimal. It just says that mass immigration is bound to be a more difficult political issue and a more difficult integration challenge for Europe than it is in the US. Now, my second set of issues is environmental. And here the issue is not whether we want immigration, but whether we want population growth. And it doesn't matter whether it's via more immigrants or more babies. Do you want population growth? And here I will express a personal point of view, or rather a personal dilemma. As chairman of the Pension Commission, I would find a little bit of population growth very helpful. As an individual concerned about our environment and as a lover of English countryside, I would quite like population stability in the UK, in Europe, and hopefully eventually across the world. We cannot permanently solve global environmental challenges, such as the increasing demands for fresh water throughout the world, unless at some time we reach global population stability. And in Southeast England, the figures we are talking about, 15 or 20 million for England, maybe 10 million of those in Southeast England, let's suppose even 5 million people, means a destruction of countryside and a level of traffic congestion, which arguably, you might say, would degrade quality of life quite as much as would the decline in the support ratio we're trying to prevent. And all for only a temporary solution to the problem. Because if you keep the ratios constant with a 30% population growth up to 2050, you need another 30% growth, another 25 million people in Britain, to keep them stable up to 2100, and again every 50 years thereafter, which in the end might prove impossible if the whole world reaches population stability and you can no longer raid the base of someone else's pyramid. Posing the question, if at some stage we need to design a society which works with column-shaped demography, why not do it now with a population of 60 million rather than in 50 or 100 years' time with a population of 80 or 100 million? So there could be quality of life reasons for Europeans to oppose population growth and therefore to oppose immigration, not to oppose immigration because of immigration. That might be a welfare-maximising choice. But of course, that is not the choice that the US appears to be making. In the US, as in Europe, fertility rate trends would fairly soon produce population stability in the absence of immigration. But the population of the US is predicted to rise by 30% over the next 50 years, almost entirely due to immigration and the knock-on effects of immigration, the fact that immigrants in themselves have children. So why is it different for the US? Well, one very simple reason is population density. US population density, and I've leant over backwards to be fair here because I have excluded Alaska from the US figures but kept the expansive wastes of northern Sweden and Finland in the European comparison. US population density is one-third of that of the European Union's. And even when we think of the most densely populated parts of the US, they are far less densely populated than Europe. 50 million people live in England. Roughly the same number live in five of America's more densely populated northeastern states, New York, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and New Jersey together. But the population density of those five states is 40% of England's. But it is not actually in those states that the population growth is occurring, but in still less densely populated states like Florida, California, Texas, and Arizona. Two-thirds of all US population growth over the last 20 years has been concentrated in nine southern and western states with an average population density a third of that of Europe's and a tenth of that of England and of the Netherlands. And a similar proportion of future population growth is forecast to be in those states in future. And I suggest that that changes the politics and indeed maybe the rational economics of immigration quite fundamentally. Americans who do not like the changing ethnic complexion of their neighborhood, or Americans who just want more space, still have the option of moving to the spacious suburbs being carved out of greenfield land on the edges of Atlanta, Dallas, San Antonio, Phoenix, Denver. Europeans don't have that option. Americans can still get the support ratio benefits of immigration without as many integration difficulties and without local environmental pressures. And that, rather than the inherent racism or conservatism of Europe, is, I suggest, why the politics of immigration are quite different in Europe than they are in the US. And indeed, why the economic impact of population growth could also be different. Because another issue raised by this population growth debate is the economic costs of population density, an issue which I believe receives insufficient attention in our comparison of US and European economic performance. The US has a significant productivity advantage over Europe, and that productivity advantage has increased in the last 10 years, the US productivity miracle. But detailed analysis does not reveal a generalized efficiency advantage across the economy, but instead that almost all of the difference is concentrated in specific sectors where expansive physical layout and ease of transport flows can have a big influence on productivity, specifically in retailing and wholesale distribution. And the most striking studies suggest that 60% of the entire difference between US and European productivity in the last 10 years is explained by the huge productivity achievements achieved in the retail sector by new US retail formats opening on large greenfield sites. Walmart, Home Depots, Circuit Cities opening what are called the big out-of-town sheds. Greenfield developments, which are far easier in the US due to more plentiful supply of land zoned for retail use, leading some people to argue for looser planning restrictions in Britain to unleash retail productivity growth. But our tighter planning controls are a natural response to population density. Welfare maximizing planning rules would trade off the potential productivity benefits of easier and more expansive development against consumer preferences for preserved countryside, less noise, less congestion. But almost any specification of a utility preference function would suggest that the value that consumers should rationally place on those benefits will increase the higher the population density. And that by way, the way, is a value which has a concrete economic expression in the way that house prices vary according to location and fall when new road developments or whatever are passed nearby. And that means that the optimal trade-off is bound to entail tighter controls in a more densely populated country, and that densely populated countries compared with less dense probably should sacrifice the final few points of productivity potential, suggesting perhaps some internal contradictions within government assumptions and desires. The UK government has, as I've said, increased its sustainable growth estimate to reflect higher immigration. It is interested in easier planning rules to enable higher productivity, and it is worried about the high and rising level of house prices. But if the population rises further, public demands for tight planning can only increase, and house prices will go up further. Even in purely economic terms, we face far more complex issues and trade-offs than a straightforward discussion of support ratios alone. Finally, a comment on geopolitics. The implication of what I've said on culture, on environment, on economics could be that the rational welfare maximizing choice for Europe would be a population growth rate slower than the US and therefore a lower rate of immigration. Europe might be a happier place with a stable population, even if that means that either worker or pensioner consumption has to be lower than in the alternative growing population case. But even if this were a rational choice in terms of individual welfare, it would clearly have consequences for geopolitical power and influence. Since given even equivalent levels of productivity increase, US total GDP would grow significantly faster in line with total population growth. So the continued rise of US geopolitical and military power relative to Western Europe and relative to Russia is almost bound to continue, and that relative shift will be even more dramatic if Europe turns its back on immigration. Which might, in Robert Kagan's words, be another case of Europe choosing paradise over power and raising a still wider set of issues, which, however, I'm going to have to leave aside for now and move on towards conclusion. So if not immigration, what about increasing fertility, as The Economist seems to be urging and as David Willetts in a recent pamphlet suggested we should consider? And I'm sure that many of you will spot immediately that the problem is that higher fertility solutions carry exactly the same total population implications as immigration. Indeed, on average, they require slightly larger total populations than immigration because of children. Under both, you need a permanently expanding population because workers age into retirees and then you need more workers to support them. But at least immigrants can enter the country as workers rather than having to grow up in it first. But that rather second-order effect aside, immigration and increased fertility are exactly the same in terms of their implications for population growth, given any similar impact on support ratios. Which implies that if you didn't want to keep support ratios constant via immigration because of environmental concerns, you should be as opposed to driving fertility back above replacement levels. Even that is if you could actually achieve that, which I think is extremely doubtful. There being no late 20th century case of a country which has fallen below replacement fertility and then risen above it, suggesting that while the immigration-based route to maintaining stable support ratios is debatable, but at least possible, the fertility-based route is probably simply impossible. But there could still be a good argument, and perhaps some feasibility, of trying to increase fertility rates in Europe, and also, for instance, in East Asia, at least somewhat. Because if environmental considerations argue for population stability, they do not require population decline. And when you get actual population decline, the support ratio mathematics becomes so extreme that it is difficult to imagine any combination of retirement age change and increased worker taxes or savings which can prevent really quite large falls in pension living standards. And some European countries, in particular Italy and Spain, are presently on target to move not only from pyramids to columns, but to this shape, which, well, what should we call it? I guess it's a sort of beehive. And there, therefore, I think, might be major economic benefits if European birth rates returned not to the 2.5s or 3s, which we saw in the 1950s, which I think are just not going to occur again, but a little bit up towards replacement rate, rather than staying in the low ones, the sort of 1.2, 1.3 level where they are at the moment. And the good news is that if that is feasible, it almost certainly depends on enabling women to make the choices they want to make, rather than cajoling them into becoming hero mothers of the European Union as their contribution to solving our pension crisis. For it is a striking feature of surveys that when you ask women in rich developed countries how many children they expect to have and would like to have, the answer is usually a bit higher than the present actual completed family sizes that we see, and actually, rather fortuitously, turns out remarkably close to the replacement level of two. But that what seems to happen is that a variety of barriers, difficulties of taking career breaks, delays in forming families driven by economic considerations, prevent women, and in particular graduate professional women, from meeting the aspirations that they say they have. Which implies that the modern natalist strategy, far from being one which attempts to return women to the traditional limits of hearth and home, is one which better enables women to combine working life and family life, careers and children. A hypothesis confirmed by the fact that across Europe, while fertility rates are below two everywhere in Western Europe, the very lowest are in those countries, such as Italy, Spain, Greece and Germany, where levels of female participation in the workforce are also lowest, and where aspects of social organisation, such as shop opening or school hours, have not been well designed to make it easy for women to combine work and family life. So perhaps we should have a strategy to encourage European birth rates to rise, but if so, it is one which reinforces rather than undermines the changing role of women, which has in itself been the driver of the fall in birth rates from historically high levels. So let me sum up and suggest some implications for public policy debate. Demographic changes face us with social choices far more fundamental than those between different pension systems, state or private, defined benefit or defined contribution. And there are indeed still wider social and cultural issues which I have not considered, such as whether an ageing and low fertility society is less creative, less innovative, less entrepreneurial, or such as whether improvements in urban geography and planning could enable us to have higher populations with less impact on the environment. So I have not considered all issues. But from what I have considered, I would draw out these key points. First, that we probably will have to face, hopefully eventually throughout the whole world, increasing longevity and, at most, replacement fertility rates, which implies column-shaped, not pyramid-shaped, demographics. And overall, for the whole world, that's very good news because people are living longer and because the world population may stabilise, which is good for the environment. Second, however, that this poses a severe problem for pension systems because pension systems have always previously operated within pyramid demographics. All our inherited pension systems are, to a degree, pyramid schemes. They're economics of contributions and receipts, only sustainable because until now each successive generation has been larger than the one before. When the population stabilises, the pyramid scheme comes to an end. And that is a big problem which cannot be fully offset, even by fully proportional rises in retirement age. Third, that attempts to get round this problem by investing overseas or by encouraging immigration, i.e. by attempting to lay your hands in some way or other on the base of someone else's population pyramid, can only be transitional solutions, and in the case of mass immigration have wider implications, political, environmental and economic, which we need to debate. Fourth, therefore, that we will not be able, at least in the long run, to avoid changes in the pattern of intergenerational consumption and transfers, either by significantly increasing worker contributions or savings, or by accepting less prosperous pensioners. Adjustments which could occur either as a result of overt public policy decisions or via market forces encouraging individuals to adjust life cycle consumption smoothing decisions. Fifth, however, that there are policies which clearly make sense however you resolve the debatable issues, since they help limit the deterioration of support ratios. And these policies are labour market focused. We need to increase average retirement ages, implying careful thinking about the tax and pension system changes which would encourage that, but also about the labour market policies, anti-age discrimination, training, flexible working, which will make it possible for older people to be valued employees. We need to encourage high levels of employee participation by the working age population because that too contributes to better support ratios. But we also need women participating in the workforce to be able more easily to combine that with having the number of women, number of children they say they want. And that implies an approach to labour market regulation, for instance, to parental, both maternal and paternal rights, which recognises the legitimate role of some regulation to support essential social objectives while still preserving the flexibility which we know is required for high employment levels. But above all and overall, we need to start debating the full and very challenging set of social choices we face, because they are much more far-reaching than the details of pension system design. Thank you very much.
Well, what a tour de force. I'm sure not everybody here agrees with what has been said. So, who would like to start with a comment or question? Jonathan.
You said on the one hand that environmental considerations.
Thank you. You said on the one hand that environmental considerations dictated that we should not, there was little or no case for increased population. On the other, however, that there was an economic case for getting total fertility rates back up to replacement ratios.
Yeah.
That slightly suggests that there is some economic theory or model behind your thinking which implies that Europe's population, and indeed England's with its population density that you showed, and Sweden's with its very much lower population density, is somehow optimal from an economic and environmental point of view. And I. There's clearly no way that we can know that, and I was interested why 60? I mean,
there is no magic on 60, and I don't think we have here a sort of general equilibrium theory for environment versus economics. Why I would end up at the common sense proposition that stability might have some environments absent benefits absent the support ratio problem would go as follows. It would say, you know, clearly, the higher you take population density in countries which are reasonably densely populated already, and in that respect I would describe southeast of England as being in a different position from Scotland, right? you just intuitively feel that further increase from the present level would produce environmental impact, and indeed would be resisted. And it is resisted through the mechanism of people voting for politicians who oppose new housing in Southeast England. Now that's a consumer preference being expressed. I mean, there's no way we can have a general theory which does this from a sort of ex cathedra, but you have to accept that expressions of political opinion are expressions of consumer preference, which tell us something about optimal results. All of which says to me that at least in densely populated areas, I think there is something to be said against further significant population increase. So why don't I say that the optimal population of England is not 50 million rather than 30 million? Well, maybe if I could roll back five centuries and be a sort of, you know, benevolent dictator, I might have preferred a population of 30 million. But once you're at 60 million, first of all, you've built houses for 60 million. So the process of getting back to the environment that it would have been with 30 million is going to be an immensely expensive process. And secondly, it's this point that if you actually shrink populations, you know, you really do generate support ratio mathematics, which, you know, blow all pension systems apart. So have I got a general equilibrium theory of balancing environmental factors and economics which tells me it's exactly 60 million? No. But I think there could be some common sense propositions which make one favourable towards population stability, but not actually to population decline. Sorry, the positive externalities
are national.
Oh yes, that's absolutely true. The positive externalities would be national, and the negative externalities could be local. So therefore, it could be possible again that the result which results from a voting process is not the economically optimal result because of that. I accept that's true.
Thank you. Could I ask? Is this on? Yeah. No. For some clarification or further information. When you talk about, and you've quoted in all your tables, a retirement age of 65, and then suggested it might be a good idea to raise it to 68, 69, is it a retirement age, which is, or is it both of these issues that are crucial in talking about retirement age? Is it an age up until which everybody works full-time and pays the relevant taxes, or is it the age at which people start to want to actually draw a pension? Because I think that might make a bit of difference. And all your figures say 65, half the women, no women so far are working till 65, so have you cut them out of the original ideas?
Because there's some women are working till
65. Yeah, but you know what, generally 60.
I get the question entirely, and it's a very good question. When you present this stuff on a comparative basis and out of models, you have to simplify things by using support ratios that assume that everybody works up to an age and then everybody is in pension beyond that. What actually matters to the support ratios is that the average age up to which people work increases, but also that the average age at which they start taking a pension increases as well. Because actually it turns out when you run the mathematics that to make significant changes in the ratio, you have to operate on the numerator and the denominator at the same time. That does not, however, imply that it either is the case or should be the case that everybody works up to some age and then stops working. And indeed, if we want to get increases in the average retirement age, one of the things that we need to do is get away from the idea that we work up to that age and then we stop. The way of getting increase in average retirement age is almost certainly involves a greater use of part-time work among older people, so that people may work up to, say, 60 years full-time and then slowly decrease their involvement in the workforce over, say, a 10-year period. There is also an extremely interesting and important arena of public policy, which deals with the fact that a lot of people, even in their 50s, are not in the workforce. They're either out of the workforce entirely and counted as economically inactive, often claiming incapacity benefit. And there is an entire wing of government policy focused on whether those people could come into gainful employment. And I think it is highly likely that the optimal social solution to this involves situations in which, to another of your points, there probably will be some points in which people are already drawing a bit of a pension but are still having a part-time earnings. Part-time jobs and earnings. The other thing to say on women is, in the UK what is happening is that the official state retirement age is moving from 60 to 65 in five movements every 2 years between 2010 and 2020. And that increase in itself therefore increases the average retirement, increase the average retirement age in the UK quite significantly. And indeed that is why if you turn from these modelled figures to UK specific figures, actually our support ratios don't really deteriorate between now and 2020. That increase, which is already planned in female retirement ages, deals with our support ratios up to 2020. The problem is that beyond that, and in an accelerated surge which is driven by the baby boom effect, they then deteriorate quite rapidly over the course of the next 10 and 20 years thereafter.
Martin?
Thank you very much. I have three short questions. The first relates to your removal of assumptions about productivity growth. But it actually seems to me that's a hugely important question, depending, of course, on the nature of the commitment you have to the retired. Because I would have thought the fundamental question is not the contribution rates that the workers will make, but whether their after contribution and after tax incomes are rising or falling in real terms. The second question I made is that the question I'd like to raise is, in all these assumptions about support ratios and immigration, the implicit assumption is that in some sense the immigrant is a perfect substitute for the domestic worker in all characteristics. To put it very mildly, that is not always the case. And therefore it really does seem to me obvious that the economic characteristics of the migrant is crucial to all these calculations. Yeah. Obviously, in many parts of Europe, many immigrants aren't employed at all, and therefore they're not adding to support. And the final question is the most fundamental. Why do we continue, and it's related to your last answer, why do we continue with the notion of retirement at all? Why don't we just, from a policy point of view, focus on the notion of incapacity to work? Why should anyone actually be expected to retire if they are able to work?
Right, well, to respond to those, I think I did leave aside the productivity issue, and obviously one response to declining support ratios is to say, well, we're going to have less workers, we need to make them work more efficiently. And indeed, this is one of the ways in which funded schemes might have a benefit, if by increasing funded schemes you could increase the national savings rate. Now, that is a big question, and for instance, those people who assert that it will have to deal with the fact that on the whole throughout the world there is an inverse correlation between the countries that have funded pension schemes and aggregate national savings rates. But if you could, by funded schemes on top of pay-as-you-go schemes, increase the aggregate national savings rate, you would increase the capital stock, you would increase the productivity rate of future workers. There's a set of arguments which I set out in my other lecture as to why that might tend to be at declining marginal return, just on a classic declining marginal efficiency of capital argument, but still there would be a net benefit. And clearly we do need to try and increase productivity as much as possible. Having said that, I think one should be very careful of making that an escape route from problems, because there is a tendency suddenly sometimes to say, oh, well, this problem is completely soluble by just working better and working more productively. I mean, if we knew how to achieve productivity improvements, we'd probably want to achieve that and would probably already have achieved that quite separate from this problem. So one has to be a bit wary of bringing in productivity improvements as the sort of deus ex machina solution. Secondly, on support ratio and characteristics of immigrants and skills, etc., that is clearly very important. Frankly, from the point of view of an economic benefit, there is clearly the optimal economic strategy is to have a highly selective immigration strategy. It is to let people in with high skills or who bring capital or who have proven entrepreneurial records, and not to let people in who have low skills. Now, that does raise for some people an ethical issue of whether you are cream-skimming other countries of their skilled groups. But if you are just interested in your national self-interest, and if you think you can control your borders and discriminate, I think it is undoubtedly the case that you would follow a selective immigration strategy. Interestingly, in terms of immigration to the UK at the moment, the best analysis I've seen is that it is sort of bimodal. It has very few people of, as it were, medium skill level. It has a lot of people towards the high end of the skill occupation, and it has a large number right at the bottom. Thirdly, I think I agree with you by retirement, and maybe I didn't make it clear. I think we need to get away from the idea that there is a point at which one is declared retired. I think what there is people work, and then over a period of time, which may be from 60 to 70, 65 to 70, but for some people it'll choose to be to 75, they will do a bit less work. They might choose to reduce their hours commitments. And during that period of time, they will have a mixed stream of income, and they will make decisions about the balance between work and pensions according to how that mixed stream evolves. And in that, the idea that somebody is, quote, retired will really only apply when people are, you know, very old and frail. I have to say, I think I'm always amazed at my father. Love him as I do. He took early retirement at the age of 62. He comes from a family where his father and his father's brothers all died aged 98, 99, and 100, and he is therefore going to spend 40 years in retirement. This strikes me as an extraordinary thing to do, and he is also personally going to single-handedly bankrupt the local government pension scheme, who didn't study the Turner family genes when they gave him this early retirement package.
Hello. As usual, I very much enjoyed your talk. Perhaps a more intuitive than empirical observation, but it is, I think, pretty well proven by the OECD, amongst others, that the UK has greater wealth now than it's ever seen before. And so surely one of the factors that has to be calculated into any disparaging or worries about the pension system is that wealth is going to cascade to the next generation. Oh. And if we are worried about that, and a way to, of course, make more cascade is to eliminate inheritance tax. And given that we've got fewer and fewer children, that would tend to point to more and more wealth cascading down because there's fewer children to give it to. So I wonder if you just have a comment on that.
Well, this is, as it were, the next bit of the macroeconomics that I think within the Pension Commission we have to understand, which is particularly to do with housing equity, because that's where the big figures are. And remember, housing equity is a much bigger figure than pension funds. I mean, pension funds are of the region of £800 billion in the UK. Gross housing equity is of the region of £2,000 billion, and even after mortgage debt, we're talking about £1.2 trillion or so, £1,200 billion. And it really is a very tricky issue to get one's brain around, because at one level, when you have funded pension schemes and you invest in capital assets, you can say, well, what you're doing is you're establishing a claim on a profit stream. But actually what you really do is you accumulate assets and then you sell them on to the next generation. And it turns out that all the problems of declining return, which might relate to higher savings in a sort of holding them model, turn into falling asset prices in a selling them model. But what that then, the question asks is, well, can people in retirement live on sold housing equity? And the answer is maybe, and maybe on average, in which case we then have a problem of particular people who fall through the cracks. I mean, the interesting thing to ask is, if we are now, as we are, not just at the first generation of people who own houses, but the second generation of houses, and if the typical average person gets to at about 55 or 60, and that is the point at which they have paid off the mortgage on their house, right, which they've spent their lifetime paying off, that is probably precisely the point, on average, where they, on average, inherit half of a house which is surplus to their housing requirements because they've already got a house. So can you see this cascade of housing equity as a possible solution. Well, the key thing to say is it doesn't get you round the problem that you can't live on houses. You know, somewhere in here there is a transfer of real resources going on. You know, if pensioners are to consume restaurant meals, you know, not all the restaurant meals can be consumed by workers. You know, a transfer of production has to go from workers to retirees under any system. But there are some very complicated issues to do with accumulated assets, and in particular about housing assets versus pension fund assets. And in about 6 months' time, I hope to be able to give you the answer to that question.
Last question here.
I was particularly struck by the graph, the last graph on the screen, and the generally successful United States demographic policies and their growing influence in the world. This is, and the decline of Europe. This is influenced by a society where culturally the state has very little influence in the provision of welfare. Europe, generally speaking, we live in a society where governments have a role for provision for the old, provision for old age pensions. We know that to our cost when we pay very high rates of tax. Is it not possible now to start to cross a cultural taboo, a cultural threshold, and accept that perhaps the state, especially in Britain, does not have a role in the provision of old age welfare?
Well, I don't think that what you're inferring from that chart is actually a reasonable inference at all, because the increase in the American population relative to the European population is entirely driven by immigration. Quite straightforwardly driven by immigration. If you run forward the US fertility characteristics of the population which is already in the US and you exclude immigration, the US population will stabilize at only about 10 million or so above where it is at the moment. Because it is not the case. I mean, some people say, Europe has low demography because Europe no longer likes themselves, it's a place of depression. Actually, there's no sign of this whatsoever. I mean, broadly speaking, white Americans, white prosperous Americans, have pretty much the same demography as Europeans. They're towards the higher end. They're at the sort of France-Sweden level, not the Italian level, but they are still below replacement level. So on a domestic fertility basis, the US population will stabilize a little bit later and less dramatically than the European level. So I don't see how you can then link that to welfare, non-welfare, unless you believe that all of those immigrants are rushing in to America to enjoy non-welfare. But that's sort of the opposite of the admittedly probably overstated scare stories that people sometimes set around that immigrants are in pursuit of welfare. So I think, you know, I think there's an interesting debate about welfare states, marginal rates of taxation, and the balance between private and public in this. But I think it's really a separate issue, which is not related to that difference in population growth rates.
All right, very last.
Thank you, sir, for a splendid lecture. I wonder how feasible it would be for European states to make use of contract labour, that's to say, recruit workers from other parts of the world on a 5-year or 10-year basis, part of the contract being they return to their homelands after their five or 10-year stint is finished. This, I think, would give more people in the third world, for instance, an opportunity, at least for part of their life, to be earning Western-type wages.
Yeah. I have to say that I am wary of that idea. I mean, it's basically, I'll borrow the base of someone else's population pyramid, but I'll send it back before they get old so that they never end up in the apex as a dependent pensioner. I really don't think that works. I mean, that was the attempted model of the German Gastarbeiter in the 50s and 60s. But actually, if you are at all a decent society, once people are working there, you have to let their families join them. Their families will join them in any case. Once they've been there for a period of time, I think it becomes pretty intolerable not to give them equal citizenship rights. So I do think that ultimately the choice on immigration is real immigration, and they're going to end up as citizens of the country to which they move, or not immigration in the first place. I'm not convinced that there's either a workable or really an ethically acceptable halfway stage.
Well, Adair, thank you very, very much. This is an extraordinary tour de force, like lectures you've given us before. An incredibly important set of issues. We'll go on arguing about them. Perhaps if our life expectancy continues to rise, we might even solve them before we come to the end. Thank you very, very much.